Our next speaker is Catherine Nance. Cathy is a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and heads up the Retirement Incomes and Asset Consulting Group within the PricewaterhouseCoopers practice in Australia. She has more than 15 years' experience advising superannuation funds, companies and state governments on superannuation and investment-related issues. Cathy also chairs the Institute of Actuaries Retirement Incomes Task Force, is a member of the International Accounting Standards Task Force, and a member of the International Actuaries Association Social Security and Pension Benefits Committee. And Catherine is going to talk to us on redefining superannuation, the unfinished agenda. Thanks, Cathy.
Hi, everyone. I'm basically going to take for an assumption that all the demographic drivers are basically a given. So we know we're getting older. We're actually also getting fatter. And consequently, our costs are increasing, particularly in health, and productivity is falling, as Anne covered off this morning. We are well placed compared to overseas in managing these costs because we have quite a low funded age pension system at 25-26% average weekly earnings and means tested. You know, at what we're looking like going forward is so much better than what a lot of other countries are looking like going forward. So they have to make really quite much more substantial reform probably than what we have to make, but we do still need to keep making it. We have had some improvements recently in workforce participation rates and fertility rates, but our longevity is continuing to increase more than what we expected at the time of doing the 2002 intergenerational report, so that counterbalances some of that. There is a limited range of solutions. We do either reduce government expenditure on the elderly or sick or increase taxes. The more preferred options, I think, are to focus on increasing savings, increasing retirement age, and I'm going to look at a couple of ways in which we might do that, and using our existing savings more effectively. So my focus today is really on the government side, what sort of policy changes, what sort of reform changes might continue to push these three things forward. So if we start with the May budget changes, they were on the whole pretty significant reform and considerably simplified super, and I think will make a big difference in the sense that at least we can just get rid of this complexity and people actually understand it. They may not yet save more, but at least it's understandable. So we simplified the inputs, how money goes in and how long you can put money in for. But the three key changes are really the fact that there's the benefits post age 60 are tax-free from funded schemes. There's no forced withdrawals anymore. You can just take whatever you want out at any time post 65. And also we improved the asset test as well for people. So before, there was no doubt that the average person had absolutely no incentive to save. If they understood the means testing and the asset test under the age pension means test, they would have realised that they just shouldn't have put in voluntary savings because everything they saved and generated extra income in retirement was offset by a reduced age pension. So it was really fundamental that that was done, that that asset test was modified so that there is some reward now for people to save. I think the best thing is that it's just a clear tax situation now, 15% in, nothing coming out. So what are the roadblocks still to saving, and particularly to saving earlier? There's probably a growing understanding that inertia is really a big, big problem, not just for us, but generally overseas. There's lots of examples coming out now how inertia is one of the main causes of like poor behaviour. There was a US 2005 MetLife insurance study which showed that 7 in 10 people listed their number one financial risk and concern, not having enough money to cover their costs, were they disabled or to cover, you know, their families if they were to die. So 7 in 10 listed that as their key financial concern, but only 4 had any insurance at all, and only 2 of the 4 even knew what insurance they had. So it's this inertia that stops people largely from taking those sort of decisions. In Australia, and again, picking up an insurance issue again, something like 99% of all super fund members in Australia only have default insurance cover, and default insurance cover is around about $50,000, hardly significant. Only 30% of people have income protection cover, which is probably the most valuable sort of cover we can all have because it protects our income, and that's largely because income protection cover is rarely offered as automatic cover. So we need to find ways to get over this inertia. One of the other reasons why people don't save early enough is the fact that they are focused on things like paying off HECS and the thought that they will be buying a home, and retirement seems too far out there, so they're unlikely to want to lock up savings now when they know they're going to be wanting to use them in the meantime. And the other things are a poor understanding of the advantages of saving earlier, the fact that you've got to save double at 45 what you would save at 25. And what your needs are in retirement, as talked about this morning. $500,000 lump sum might seem great until you realise it's only going to buy you an income each year of about $30,000 per annum. So all those things are really some of the roadblocks to getting people to save earlier. So what might be some of the policy solutions to that? Well, why don't we auto-enrol member contributions, mandatory auto-enrolment of a basic level of member contributions with an opt-out option. So you're not forcing people to keep contributing to super, but you are putting them in there and they've got to opt out. Combine that with access to a maximum, say, 100,000 lifetime lump sum limit that they can get out at any age from their additional voluntary contributions, not from SG. And suddenly you've got a system where they're going to get used to saving. They know they can get access to the money to buy the house, so it's not locked away. And we're more likely, and what have we got to lose by doing that? What we've got to lose is that they draw out all their voluntary super up to 100,000, but they're not putting it in now anyway. So what's the worst we can do from it? All we'll do is we'll teach them how to live on less income and how to get used to saving. And yes, they might draw it out in their 20s or 30s to buy a house, but they're going to have been used to paying it. We have absolutely no savings culture in Australia. We lost it long ago. The only savings culture we've got is buying a house. So we need to get it back, and maybe we need to do something a bit more fundamental in order to get it back. If we bought in a system like that, then I should think we should make that maximum 100,000 lifetime lump sum limit apply to all ages up to age pension age. And therefore, the preservation age and the ability to draw out everything post-preservation age would disappear, which I think would be a real positive, because we have a real mismatch at the moment between preservation age at 60 and age pension commencing at 65. And we may also need to look at things like, you know, if you draw your money out just prior to 65, that could get picked up in the gifting rules under the age pension rules. So you can still draw it out, but it might limit your ability to take a full age pension if you did. But I'm always wary about putting in arbitrary rules like that, because I think all you do is force people to take their money out at 59 rather than 60. So you've got to be careful about doing things like that, and you may not need it anyway. And the other change, I think, is, so that's really getting over inertia, the idea behind that. The other change is to get over this lack of understanding. And I think it would be really good to have some sort of mandatory reporting. We all get mandatory reporting of our superannuation benefits, our resignation benefits every year. But what about mandatory requiring that to also be disclosed as an income post age 65? So someone who's in their 20s or 30s and, you know, sees they've got 30,000 in there, suddenly sees that it only equates to a 2,000 a year income post 65, might suddenly realise that it's actually pretty insignificant and they'd have to save a lot more. And it's just adding one more line item to an annual report. The other areas that we really need to focus on is changing our workplaces. As we've already talked about this morning, we do need ways in which to increase people working longer. That should help our health. I'm not quite sure what the chicken and egg is, actually. Whether your health needs to improve to work longer is probably an element of that, but I think working longer actually also keeps you healthier as well, because it keeps you more active, so it's probably a bit of both. Improves your finances and improves the country's productivity. There are supply of jobs issues and demand of jobs issues to address. So the problems are in both the supply and the demand area. And the government has done a lot, I think, to date to at least get it out there in public awareness that we're probably going to have to work longer. And it's starting to filter through into companies. The awareness is growing. I won't say it's really widespread yet about how they're going to sort of do this, encourage people to stay on longer, but it is starting to grow. And just one example I took was a company that we deal with through PwC who has started looking at these issues. And they looked at their workforce in their call centre. Under 35s in their call centre, their current workforce was 60%. The customers were at 20%. And the new employees, and where all their recruitment efforts were focused, was on under 35 recruitment, and consequently they were being quite successful at the moment in getting in 80% of all new employees into that age group. So there's a bit of a mismatch there because like tends to service like better, and you tend to start to get a growing dissatisfaction if your servicing people don't reflect your customers. And if you look at the over 55s in the same call centre, current workforce was 10%, customers 50%, new employees were zero. So all their recruitment policies were targeted to the young, and they were continuing to grow this mismatch between their customers and who was servicing them. And it was creating dissatisfaction in the responses to the call centre. 50% of the customers now, population is aged over 55. It's going to be two-thirds by 2040. 80% of our workforce growth is going to come from over 45s within one decade. And why is the only thing I ever hear people standing up at seminars talking about is Gen X, Gen Y? How do we attract them and keep them? Because to be honest, I think there's some focus to that. We have to be conscious of what will attract and retain them. But we're missing the boat in terms of the bigger section of the audience out there that we need to address, keep and attract, and we're just missing it completely. Even the latest superannuation conference in Perth just a week ago had a Gen X, Gen Y thing, and it must have been the sixth, you know, that I could have gone to in the past 2 years. So just moving back to policy areas now, in terms of encouraging people to not early retire, if we look at the group who are pre-65 at this stage, then currently the workforce participation rates definitely need to increase. Now the average ABS retirement age, I only just got hold of this week, and it was 58 for males and 47 for females, which seems extremely low because the OECD figures are more like early 60s. So I'm not quite sure, haven't quite got to the bottom of the difference yet. But the point is that it's much, much, much lower than 65, and it is way too early. 9 in 10 males work age 45 to 50, but it drops off to 5 to 6 by 60 to 64. So the government changes to date, I think, have been a very good start. They've got a mature age employment and welfare strategy. It's definitely out there in public awareness. They've tightened up the early retirement pathways, the easy pathways such as New Start and disability. And the May budget changes were also meant to further encourage that. And there's no doubt that for someone below the age of 60, the ability to get your benefits out tax-free after 60 is a big incentive to keep working at least to 60. There's a questionable issue about whether the May budget changes are really going to impact people aged 60 to 65 to keep them in the workforce. The intent is that by offering transition to retirement options, which is where you can draw down your super and fund lower working hours, that will keep people in the workforce. And if it does, that will be a really good positive thing. The trouble is that it's very hard to predict behavioural responses to things, and it's quite possible it could have no effect or even slightly the worse effect, whereby people actually use their super to subsidise less hours than what they otherwise would have done if they couldn't use some of their super to help subsidise. And Finland actually had a similar experiment which showed that it didn't work, that people actually just subsidised less hours than what they would have otherwise have worked. And to give you an example of how that would happen here, if even using the budget's own projections for what people are likely to have in terms of savings, which are maybe pretty optimistic, 40 years, assuming 40 years work continuous, that someone would end up with about 460,000 current day dollars saved. If someone was to use 100,000 of that to fund lesser hours from 60 to 65, they're reducing their income post age 65 by 6,000 per annum. But because of the means test on the age pension, their age pension would actually increase back up another 4,000. So they can actually use that 100,000 to fund lesser hours, and they're only going to be 2,000 a year worse off after age 65. So there's a big incentive, because of the impact of the age pension means testing, there's a big incentive to actually use some of that money, because you're not actually going to be disincentivised to do so. So what could be some further options, particularly if we don't see behaviour changing as what we'd like to see it from those May budget changes? Well, the obvious ones are you change preservation age. That's already been given a big no from the government. We can pick up gifting rules here for the age pension. We can say, you know, if you want to draw down your money pre-65, it will get picked up in the gifting rules post-age 65 for, say, 5 years. So, yes, you can use your savings, but it will stop you getting that lift up on your age pension post-age 65. So if you spend it, you've got to, you know, there's just that downside that don't expect the age pension to reward you for having spent it. Changing the tax-free of benefits age from 60 to 65, I think that was just a major opportunity we missed with these May budget changes, that we just didn't bring in tax-free benefits post-age 65 and not post-age 60, because it's going to be almost impossible to ever change that now for the time being, and yet it would have been a really... people still would have thought it was fantastic to get tax-free benefits. We could have just made it at 65, not 60. 60 is just too early. And again, educating on needs. This thing about a lot of people in their 50s have got this vision of wanting to retire, but they really don't understand what it takes to retire. And I think if we had that mandatory reporting of superannuation benefits as an income stream post age 65, sort of working on from Michael's example of having calculators, it's probably a bit more in your face, but at least it would show you that your few hundred thousand is not going to sort of, you know, buy you that much of an income. In regards to post age 65, the age pension age of 65 was brought in 1909, when our life expectancy was 65. Our life expectancy is basically 85 now for someone who's aged about 50-55. So 85 is the new 65. And I take the point raised this morning about, are we necessarily healthier, you know, at 65? But the fact is, it is the new 65. The age pension has a considerable impact on whether people work over age 65, because 80% of our people over 65 now are on the age pension, and it's only projected to reduce to 75% in the year 2040, because although the SG accounts are building, they're not building to that greater extent. And what it does is move people off the full age pension onto a part age pension, but people are still getting all or part of an age pension, 75% of them, into the future. So the rules regarding the age pension matter, because people won't readily give up on what they can see as being free dollars almost. There's three really big problems with the current age pension and how it encourages people post age 65 to work. One is the income test doesn't work at all. It was never designed for earned income. It was never envisaged that people would work past age pension age when that test was brought in. It annualises your earned income for a fortnight, so you can earn, you can do 3 months work and wipe out your age pension, even though you might not work for the next 9 months. It's very intrusive. There's a very high error rate, as Anthony Asher had done a paper once looking at the errors in the means testing. The other thing is that the means testing blocks people from really wanting to earn income. At the moment, a single person, the moment you start earning more than $3,000 a year, up to $36,000 a year, your age pension drops by 40 cents in a dollar. That's quite a high marginal tax rate to pay on earned income above $3,000 per annum. It's quite a disincentive. And yes, The senior Australian's tax offset means you don't pay any tax whilst your income is below about $25,000, but you're still paying tax through the loss of your age pension to the extent of 40 cents a year, 40 cents in a dollar, and that's basically equivalent to a marginal tax rate under the new scales of a $75,000 income. So it's too big a reduction. People aren't going to keep working at that age if they're not going to get enough reward from it. The pension bonus scheme, which is there to supposedly encourage people to defer going on the age pension, is just not significant enough. It pays people a maximum lump sum of about $30,000 after 5 years. It's about half what the government saves from people not taking up the pension for the 5 years. It's extremely restrictive. You've got to work 20 hours per week for 48 weeks for at least 12 months and make a claim within 13 weeks. So it's not really, you know, the fact that there's so few people taking out that option is probably not that surprising. So there's insufficient incentives to keep people working beyond age 65. So what can we do there is, I think there's two things. We either increase the age pension age, which is a compulsory hard hit option, or we improve voluntary incentives. If we increase the age pension in a compulsory manner, yes, the UK is proposing to do that. 68 by 2050 is their aim. It's a proposal, but definitely they put it out there and they look like that's what they're going to try to do. It can advantage higher socioeconomic groups over lower. Higher socioeconomic groups live longer, so they're going to be on the age pension for longer than lower socioeconomic groups, and it also advantages people obviously doing white collar type work over people doing very, very physical work. So it's not to say we won't have to do it or it won't become really acceptable for the government to do it at some stage, given that UK, US and other countries are looking at it, but it is a fairly hard-nosed option to take a compulsory view on the age pension age. The other options are we just create the voluntary incentives that hopefully might achieve the same behavioural responses. And we could do that, for instance, by getting rid of the income test completely. I'll take you through an example of this in a minute. We'll only have an asset test. It'll be very simple. We replace the pension bonus scheme with a deferred age pension scheme. So if you choose to live off your savings and your work, you will get a higher pension, and it will be an actuarially fair increased pension, around about 6 to 8% a year, which is what certain other countries have. Now, the government still benefits from that. They don't benefit if you do a straight financial calculation, what's it worth in 5 years' time versus what's it worth now, but they benefit because not everyone, because of mortality, not everyone will reach that point. So they benefit from mortality rather than the pure finances. And possibly we can even start to look at reducing the age pension a little bit from age 65 so we get more of an impact. So how would that work in practice? At the moment, if you earn $3,000 from earned income, you're a single person, you earn $3,000 from earned income, you get an age pension of about $13,000. $16,000 in income, you don't pay tax because senior Australian tax offset, SATO, protects your income up to about $25,000. Earn an additional $10,000 on your earned income, your pension drops $9,000 to $9,000, so you drop $4,000. You don't pay any tax still, but what we've done is essentially tax you by reducing your age pension. So let's wipe the income test. That's what's resulted in that drop. What will happen is you can earn $10,000. You still have a right to a $13,000 annual pension. We may need to get rid of SATO, the tax offset, so you do pay some tax on that, $2,000 or $3,000. And you also have the choice then of saying, so A, you haven't lost out, there's much more of a reward to do it, but you also have the choice of saying, look, I can actually earn $20,000 a year or $25,000 and live quite comfortably on that, or I can combine my earnings with my savings and live quite comfortably on that. I'll defer the age pension. The age pension can be deferred for an indefinite voluntary amount of time, all or part of it. And I'll take a higher age pension at the end of my deferral period. So let's say I try to live 5 years on income and savings. Then at the end of 5 years, my age pension is no longer $13,000, it's $18,000, which has immediately increased to that 35% ordinary weekly time earnings figure, which is considered to be a much more comfortable level. Or better still, if I say, look, I think I can survive comfortably for 10 years, then your age pension is $25,000 a year. So it hasn't cost the government anything, because that is the cost of the same amount of dollars to paying it out from age 65. And yet there's so much more of an incentive for people to, A, try to manage their income and their savings for a known period of time rather than an unknown period of time, and not being discouraged and penalised financially by trying to work beyond age 65. The other area that I think we need to focus on is a more effective use of savings in retirement. We've had, globally, there's been an absolute emphasis on the accumulation stage, globally and here in Australia, and a lot of the May budget was still about the accumulation stage. There is a growing understanding worldwide that we need to start focus on the dis-saving stage, on how people are going to use their savings, how we make them use it effectively. And government policies are needed to facilitate that product development, not provide the product. It's interesting that government actually is a reverse mortgage provider. You can top up your, you can get an age pension from the government if you're not eligible, and they'll take a hit from your house at the end. They actually, in a sense, are a reverse mortgage provider. It's not really, I don't believe, and most people I think don't believe, that it's a government's role to provide product. It's their role to facilitate the provision of good product. So what are the potential drivers of demand of product? Well, the age pension rules are just going to always be a real driver. It's just a fact. It drives demand. So many people, 80% are on it. We've got a financial planning industry geared to protecting every dollar possible of the age pension anyone could get. So we just have to bear that in mind in designing product, or get some of the rules changed. Some of the other drivers of demand, there's an increasing number of single person households. The boomers divorce a lot, and nearly 50%. So by 2011, there's going to be more boomers single because of divorce than because of widowhood, and that puts more of a strain on government finances, because when you don't have coexistence, you have more of a requirement to get support and care from the government. Obviously, a similar situation applies to females in older ages, because males die earlier. The standard, if you look at independent living units, retirement homes, the average age is around about 80. The average entry age is around about mid-70s. The average age of residence is around about 80, and 90% of them are females. You've also got to take into account the different stages of retirement, as Michael went through before, the active, inactive, and the high care stage. And there needs to be flexibility to meet aged care costs, and we're not really factoring that in at the moment, which is why it would be wrong to force people to over-annuitise their wealth, what wealth they have, because for people to get into aged care later on, they often need lump sums. The average accommodation bond this year was $125,000, and they can range up to $600,000 to get into a retirement home. And the other driver of demand is clarity around government programs. People tend not to self-provide if they think they'll get looked after by the government, or if there is a perception they will get looked after. So they won't enter into a reverse mortgage or downsize their house if they think they will be looked after by government. So it's really important that the government is very clear in terms of aged care and health care, particularly what will be provided and what won't be provided, and where the gaps are. So some of the newer products. Lifetime annuities has already been talked about before. Some facilitation might help the provision of lifetime annuities, particularly at older ages where people might be more receptive to having them. I don't think it's a good idea for 60-year-olds or 65-year-olds to take out that type of product, but maybe at 75, after they've gone into care and worked out their finances, it might be a lot better idea. But even then, insurers and people providing those sorts of things, they don't have the assets at the moment to back them. They don't have long-term fixed interest assets to back them. It's not a liquid market, and there's no reinsurance of longevity risks. It's interesting that this is becoming a real issue over in the UK, longevity bonds, and there's a belief that it could absolutely boom the longevity bond market. What longevity bonds are is it might be a 25-year bond for 65-year-olds. It's benchmarked to a population, and if that population lives longer than expected, the coupon payment increases, so that offsets for that longevity risk. And it does rely on getting reinsurance for that longevity risk. So there is a question about whether the private sector will want to embark upon that level of reinsurance or whether that's better placed with private. But there is a view in the UK that it's going to be big business. And I was over there last week, and it was interesting that this was the front page of the Financial Times. Trading and death risk offers boom for London. Headline on the Financial Times, and it's all about longevity bonds. I keep saying longevity bonds. So other products, home equity release, reverse mortgages, some of the impediments in the past, I mean, it's a great source of wealth for care particularly. Some of the impediments in the past have been product related, high costs, complicated products. But one of the impediments is, again, the age pension. Because what you release, your home is a protected asset, so but release that asset, it's no longer protected under the age pension, and you lose your age pension after a certain limited period of time. So maybe what we need to think about is allowing that release of equity to go into some sort of restricted use health savings accounts that could sit by our superannuation account. So if people release equity, they can put it into those accounts, and those accounts can then be used to meet health or care costs and would continue to be protected from the age pension. Long-term care insurance, we don't have that in Australia. There's no demand, no product. 50% of employers in the US provide this. It's what provides insurance against accommodation needs and medical costs. It failed in the UK. For similar reasons like lifetime annuities fail, the premiums were unstable and expensive, reinsurance was difficult to get, and consequently people, and there was lack of clarity as to what government was providing or not. So again, that may be something that we do have to look at. And again, the government needs to facilitate education and sound long-term product, usually by requiring really good disclosure. Just picking up on one question this morning too about the issue of insurance, I think it's not really directly related to retirement incomes, but I think there's a big issue with living longer and our current system of insurance, which is total and permanent disability or income protection, which knocks out after 2 years. What does total and permanent disability mean to a 30-year-old when life expectancy is 80, 85? I think there is a real huge gap in the market. And I think insurers do need to start looking at long-term income protection again. And I know they are all burned, and they haven't quite forgotten it yet when they tried it some time ago, but we've just got a massive gap in the market. So I believe that we do have an unfinished agenda. We have made significant reforms from the budget, but it doesn't end there. And we're at the most favourable environment now possible to keep making further reforms because everyone else is making them. UK, US, public awareness. If you want to make reform, you want to do it when everyone's reforming, really. So I just think we've got to keep at it and keep making it whilst there is that awareness and likely acceptance. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cathy. I guess those of us in the superannuation industry have been used to continuous change, and from the sound of it, we better get used to the idea it's still going to happen. Now, questions and comments for Cathy? We've got about five minutes.
Cathy, I'm delighted to see you suggesting some reduction in the income test. Have you done any sums as to the costs? The fiscal impact?
Well, no, not like in an aggregate system, but I think you've got to look at removing the SATO or a large part of it, because they should be put on a more reasonable basis that what you earn, just because you're earning at post age 65 doesn't mean that you should necessarily get a massive tax break that someone under 65 who's also in dire circumstances doesn't get, you know. So I think we need, rather than looking at just trying to tax it through the age pension, put the taxes back where they usually sit on the income side and get rid of the income test. So if you do that, there might be some costs, but there's very I think the percentage of people working over age 65 is like minute anyway. So you're not going to lose a lot of income now.
And then again, you get as a benefit.
Yeah.
I ask the forbearance of the room for this one, but we keep talking about longevity risk, and I wonder just with the advances in technology and the ability for you to effectively increase the odds of your survival and how much you get out of any product or system if you have access to genetic testing and those sort of records, whether the product design phase is made more difficult for that from an equity point of view, you know, higher socioeconomic groups compared to lower groups, and the selection issues that occur there?
I don't think there's any doubt that selection is one of the really big risks. It's one of the reasons why lifetime annuities also look expensive, because there's an assumed, you have to assume there's a selection risk happening there, that people will only take, they're not going to take out a lifetime annuity if they've just been to the doctors and got a bad prognosis. So, you know, that's definitely a really big issue where any system is voluntary, and that's often why we have to really think about whether the government does need to take a stand in being the reinsurer of last resort for longevity, because it's very hard for a private supplier to do that when it's a, when there's a selection component.
Yes, it's not just the returns on these things that are looking poor. It's the whole, like, should I go into this? Am
exactly.
I going to win or lose? And obviously people from a higher socioeconomic group.
And, you know, I was playing on a calculator yesterday, actually. It was a good one. There was one, a longevity calculator put out by an insurer in the States. And, I mean, my basic life expectancy started at 82. I could quickly get that up to 94 or get it down equally, you know, by my behaviours. So there's a massive difference in, you know, we're not a uniform group by any means in terms of how long we're going to live. There's a massive difference between different groups in terms of longevity.
Pick up on that from a UK perspective. The pricing technology in the UK market for annuities is increasing quite rapidly. We've already seen the introduction of what they call preferred annuities for smokers. So, take up smoking 2 years before you retire and you'll get a little bit more retirement income. I'm not quite sure how they test for that, but they must have a way. But they're also, companies are now also starting to get much more granular in their pricing technology for lifetime annuities, going down to, you know, sort of occupation, trying to do it by postcode, although it's quite hard to track, you know, people's history by postcode. But that's certainly a big trend. It's helped, of course, because annuitization is still, well, not quite compulsory anymore, but it is still very, very popular. And so you do have a lot of data available to be able to do that. But certainly, I think as this becomes an increasing concern for companies, the pricing technology sitting behind that's also got to adapt.
Yes, David, that'll be the last question.
David Knox. Cathy, I think most of us would agree with the idea of increasing pension ages, and as actuaries that makes a lot of sense. Let me just put a counter-argument, though, particularly in respect to preservation age, and that is a blue-collar worker who is worn out at the mid-50s. We're still going to have blue-collar workers around, and if we increase the preservation age and remove their access to super at the age of 60, 62, 65, we're in effect going to put them back on Social Security as a disability pensioner. And I think there is an argument that these blue-collar workers need access to their super at 60, recognising they'll be on the age pension subsequently.
Yep, I agree. And that's why I don't believe, actually, at this stage, I'm not a believer in compulsory increase in the age pension age from 65 for that reason. But if we allowed access to super prior to 65 but limited it to say 100,000, then that would cover them, because that would cover a lot of their savings. So we may be able to handle that on limits on access rather than just having an unfettered limit at the moment for everyone.
Well, if we could all thank Cathy for her talk and her questions.